supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Hurricane Florence is getting bigger as it targets the East Coast. According to the National Hurricane Center, it's stretching so far that it's 340 miles wide with sustained winds of 140 miles an hour. Currently centered some 800 miles east, southeast of Cape Fear, North Carolina, and moving west-northwest at 17 miles an hour. It's predicted to make landfall Friday in the Carolinas. New Jersey officials are urging residents to take precautions, even though the bulk of Hurricane Florence is expected to mostly miss the Garden State. Governor Phil Murphy said today that current forecasts show that Florence is likely to strike a glancing blow to New Jersey. It still means New Jersey's coastal areas will get heavy rain, some flooding, and high winds. Philadelphia has sent a team of first responders to South Carolina in anticipation of the arrival of Hurricane Florence. Fire Commissioner Adam Teal says the crews are specially trained in urban search and rescue.
I was talking to some former colleagues in Virginia and North Carolina, and they're expecting pretty severe inland flooding. So this really is not just a coastal event. We also expect with the weather so far, the way it's been, it's possible the team will end up doing some structural collapse rescue. But they're prepared to do anything from that to water rescue, and really it's sort of like a miniature fire department on wheels.
Another 40 firefighters could be called to do water rescue if the need arises. A new study from Jefferson University Hospital shows promising signs for reducing memory loss in older black adults. Study results could be applied to anyone growing older, but the study was focused on African Americans. That's because African Americans are nearly twice as likely to develop dementia as whites are, but the medical world has not come up with many treatments to try to prevent it. As WHYY's Nina Feldman reports, this treatment does not center around drugs or medicine. It's more about being social, active, thoughtful, and making a plan.
The study paired black Philadelphians in the early stages of memory loss with community health workers who would help them with a treatment called behavioral activation. Together, they would set some simple goals. A word search once a day, a weekly walk around the block, maybe lunch at the senior center. Joanne Akpin led the team of community health workers and remembers one patient in particular.
He had told me about a group of guys who used to meet the first Saturday of every month for breakfast just to catch up. I think they were like high school buddies or something like that. And he always kind of felt bad that he was never able to make these meetings.
So they made a plan. They figured out transportation and made sure to add it to his calendar so he didn't forget, a serious concern for people whose memories are already starting to go. The patient made the breakfast his monthly ritual. Over 3 years, behavioral activation reduced the risk of cognitive decline by almost 90% compared to a control group. Dr. Barry Rovner at Jefferson led the study. He said he doesn't expect insurers to start covering this treatment anytime soon, but he does think family members can use it with their loved ones at home. In fact, it might work best that way.
This treatment is best applied in a relationship between people, not just that somebody's going to pick it up and do it on their own or just that a doctor's going to tell you to do it, because that doesn't work.
At the end of the study, Akpin gave her patient a survey asking how satisfied he was with accomplishing his goal on a scale of 1 to 10.
He said a 12. That's how excited he was.
Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump were on hand today at the Shanksville, Pennsylvania Memorial, the site where United Airlines Flight 93 crashed on September 11, 2001, during what investigators concluded was a struggle between Al-Qaeda operatives and rebelling passengers and crew. On hand during today's ceremonies and joining me with details is WHYY's Katie Meyer. Katie, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Describe the proceedings today.
Like every year, there's a real somber atmosphere at this vigil. They start off the ceremony with the tolling of the bells. They read off all the names of the 40 passengers and crew who were on the flight and, ring a bell between each one. And that's something that was done. Paul Murdoch, actually, the architect of the memorial, led that, but a lot of family members who were there read out their family members' names. Some of them said a few words. It's a quiet, sort of serious ceremony, and it features, speeches like every year from political leaders. So this year it was President Trump and Governor Tom Wolf, former Governor Schweiker, as well as Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke.
What did the president have to say?
He was, very somber, sort of matched the mood of the day. He said he told some stories of people who were from or who died on Flight 93. He, said several things about making sure that our country is secure, sort of held up these 40 people as examples of American values, of fighting back against terrorism, that sort of thing.
Katie, describe the new memorial tower that was dedicated there this week.
Yeah, it's really a culmination of sorts of this long, long effort on the part of the family and the friends of the people who died on Flight 93. This has been something that's been, this whole memorial has been in process for years and years at this point. And the memorial that was dedicated this weekend really is the final piece. It's this 93-foot-tall tower. It's really a sculpture more than anything, and it's going to hold 40 these massive wind chimes, one for each of the passengers. Not all the wind chimes are there yet. Some of them are still being fabricated, so there were only 8 this weekend, but they did have a ceremonial ringing of them for the first time publicly on Sunday. And it's the tower is right at the beginning of the park, so this is really what's going to greet visitors as they come in. And I was talking to Paul Murdoch, and he was saying, we want something that's going to be sort of heroic and stand there and, tall and strong, but still people can go up to it and have these really personal experiences and listen to the chimes and reflect.
And is it attended primarily by family and friends each year, or was there a much larger extended cohort on hand as well?
There are always family and friends here, and you can see them. It really is. It's kind of nice to watch. All of them at this point are old friends. And so they have the seats right in front of the stage for this event. But it was a well-attended. Hundreds of people were there. And I would say the crowd sort of shifts depending on who's speaking. So there were a lot of people who were, very excited that President Trump was there, a lot of Make America Great Again hats. A big crowd. But again, I think the constant in this ceremony every year is that, yes, there's a lot of family that comes into town, a lot of friends, a lot of people who have been doing this for, 17 years now.
Flight 93, of course, crashed into an open field in this remote area, Shanksville, Pennsylvania. For those not familiar with the map, what is it near?
It's, let's see, it's in Somerset County. It's not near a whole lot. The area where the plane went down was actually an old strip mine. And so it's really just this, like, these rolling hills, sort of a not a barren landscape, but a stark landscape, I would say. It's a very, a rural place.
Katie, can you share with us what you might have heard firsthand from family members who were on hand for the unveiling of this memorial?
Yeah, so over, these past couple of days, I've had the opportunity to talk to a bunch of different family members. And one of the things that I came away with is, this has been such a long process for all of them. It's felt like this weekend has felt, especially with the dedication of the Tower of Voices, sort of like a landmark for them, just in their lives. Some of them were saying, now we've been with this, we've helped it grow to this point all these years, and eventually we have to give this to the next generation of family. So some of these people are looking, to their children, saying, it's up to them at a certain point what happens with this. So, a lot of them are still going to be very involved in the memorial and in the, Friends of Flight 93 organization. But, just looking to the future, thinking about how this is going to last through the years as a 9/11 gets more remote as people come to visit it who maybe weren't even alive when the event happened. So there was definitely a lot of looking to the future this weekend.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
WHYY's Katie Meyer on Newsworks Tonight. Pennsylvania's recent grand jury report on child sex abuse in Catholic dioceses throughout the state has renewed calls to change statute of limitations laws. As Keystone Crossroads contributor Sarah Hoover reports, advocates held a press conference today in southwestern Pennsylvania to lobby lawmakers to allow a 2-year window for past victims to file civil charges.
Families of child sex abuse survivors held signs that read, "Protect the children, not the priests," and prosecute the priests don't bury their victims, while advocates and survivors told personal stories of abuse. Former gymnast Sarah Klein lives in Delaware County and is the first known victim of Larry Nassar, the serial pedophile and former Olympic team doctor at Michigan State.
I was part of the army of survivors that successfully persuaded the Michigan legislature to pass laws opening a window of opportunity for all victims of child sexual assault to pursue justice regardless of age.
Michigan changed its laws to allow a 90-day window for Nassar's victims to file civil claims. It also lengthened its civil statute of limitations for child sexual assault and eliminated time constraints for criminal charges. Child USA and the Survivors Network of those abused by priests want Pennsylvania lawmakers to follow suit. They want the state to give past victims a 2-year window to seek civil damages, similar to Delaware. Arthur Basilis Jr.'s son was a victim who later died of a drug overdose.
There is no statute of limitations on our grief, misery, and pain.
Critics say opening up retroactive civil lawsuits would violate the Pennsylvania Constitution. Sarah Hoover for Keystone Crossroads.
Bucks County Republican Brian Fitzpatrick is only in his first term in Congress, but he's now locked in a tight reelection battle like few of his peers will face. WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo caught up with him at the Capitol recently and discussed his plan to run as a moderate, even as the nation is increasingly polarized.
When I met Fitzpatrick at his Capitol Hill office, I was surprised when the former FBI agent said we had to turn around and go do the interview outside. Once we settled on a spot, his aide was then surprised that the congressman sent him away. But his office is a congressional office, and his aide is an official aide. Fitzpatrick says he doesn't want to blur the lines between his campaign and official duties. His aide finally caught on as the congressman sent him back inside.
Yep, thanks, bud. All right, thanks.
That's funny. I've never had someone do that. Usually they just let it slide. You're a lawman.
I'm a former FBI agent, man. We do things by the book. So,
this bench?
Yeah, we do.
Not many people in the nation's capital do things by the book. Washington is more hyperpartisan now than arguably any time in the nation's history, except maybe right around the Civil War. Knowing that, Fitzpatrick is still trying to present himself as a legislator who is right in the middle.
I get objection from the right and from the left because I'm a centrist. And when you get pushback from both sides in a district like Bucks County, you know that you're exactly where you need to be.
Fitzpatrick took over the seat from his older brother, Mike, who represented the district for 8 years before retiring. The younger Fitzpatrick is proud that Georgetown University's Lugar Center listed him as the most independent first-term lawmaker in the nation. That index looks at how often lawmakers' bills attract bipartisan support and how often they sponsor legislation from the opposing party. Fitzpatrick is glad he's at the top of his class.
Everything we do in life should be a product of compromise and wanting to learn from other people, extract their good ideas, and try to see the world through their eyes.
Fitzpatrick has had legislative success, too. He's gotten his Interdict Act passed, which helps law enforcement stop illegal drugs coming in at the nation's ports of entry. And he also got his right to try legislation signed into law. It allows terminally ill patients to access drugs not yet approved by the FDA. But as the only former FBI agent in Congress, Fitzpatrick has drawn criticism for not standing up to President Trump enough on his repeated tirades against Special Counsel Robert Mueller, the Russia investigation, and even U.S. intelligence agencies themselves. Fitzpatrick serves on the Homeland Security Committee. When asked by WHYY, the top Democrat on that committee, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, struggled to remember who he even is.
Brian Fitzpatrick. Make me know him.
Pennsylvania congressman?
No. He's a Republican.
Yeah.
Yeah. He hadn't distinguished himself on the committee.
That's interesting. Were we that hyper-partisan these days that you don't know him or just
no.
He's quiet?
I don't know him. No.
Still, Fitzpatrick has Democratic allies. He's a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus, a 48-member group of Republicans and Democrats who try to avoid the headline-grabbing issues that divide the parties and focus on common ground. Democrat Josh Gottheimer from North Jersey is a co-chair of the caucus. He recently did an event with Fitzpatrick in Bucks County and says he wants to see him win another term in D.C.
I'm focused on making sure people like Brian Fitzpatrick, you know, are going to be in the Problem Solvers Caucus. I'm focused on what's best for America, less on what's best for national party politics.
Fitzpatrick's Democratic opponent, Scott Wallace, says Fitzpatrick is using that bipartisan caucus as a smokescreen. Wallace worked as a staffer in Washington on the Senate Judiciary and Veterans Affairs Committees during the Reagan era. He says Fitzpatrick is playing Washington games with voters.
There's one word that you'll never hear from Brian Fitzpatrick, and that's Republican. And that's why he likes to run around saying he's going to be your independent voice in Congress. But bottom line, this is a very moderate district. He knows that. Trump is not popular here. But the fact is, he is on Team Trump.
While Fitzpatrick voted against the GOP's Obamacare repeal effort, he supported the Republican tax overhaul that killed the Affordable Care Act's health insurance mandate. Wallace says that's not all.
He voted for Speaker Ryan, who controls the floor, who brings up bills that Trump wants and buries bills that Trump hates. He votes for the Trump agenda the vast majority of the time, about 85%. He voted for what Trump views as his proudest legislative accomplishment, the tax bill.
Fitzpatrick says he wants to see some sort of health insurance mandate put back in place, but he has no regrets on that tax vote.
It's hard to argue a success, right? You know, we went from 1.5, 1.6 growth in GDP to 2.7 last year, and we're going to be hovering around 3, if not exceeding 3 this year. You can't argue with success. Some can say that's a coincidence. I disagree.
Even while discussing these votes and the Trump tax policy, Fitzpatrick avoids mentioning the president by name or the Republican leadership in Washington. And Fitzpatrick is now trying to double down on his promise to legislate from the middle if given the chance by voters.
Scott Wallace wants to shrink the Problem Solvers Caucus. We want to expand it. We think that that's the only hope for our country. The Hatfield and McCoy brand of politics must end. And he's a part of that.
With millions of dollars pouring into the district and more expected to come from both sides, it's becoming one of the hottest races to watch during these midterm elections. And because it's a district that went for Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, while mostly choosing Republicans for Congress, both parties have reason to believe they can win this seat. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Nearly 1,800 acres of state-owned forest in Pennsylvania have been cleared for gas drilling over the past decade, wiping out critical habitat for native species. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier heard from researchers who are trying to bring some of it back.
Kelly Sitch is an ecologist with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and right now he's walking in a clearing deep in the Tyodotten State Forest in north-central Pennsylvania. We're surrounded by wildflowers and tall grasses in what is essentially an outdoor laboratory.
Here's a mix that was all native grasses and wildflowers. As you can see right now, this appears to be solid wild bergamot.
Sitch and a group of scientists have divvied up this clearing into dozens of small plots, each planted with different species. The one we're standing next to was planted with wild bergamot. It's a native species with light purple flowers that look like pom-poms. Butterflies and bees hover over these chest-high flowers on this warm summer morning.
This is only a 13 by 13 foot square, but to a bumblebee, this is a fantastic ecosystem right here. So it wouldn't take a very large portion of a well pad edge to provide a lot of ecosystem benefits.
DCNR has leased over 100,000 acres of state forest to the gas industry for fracking in the Marcellus Shale. Here in the Tyodotten, the industry has cut down around 1,000 acres of forest to make way for well pads, pipelines, and compressor stations. Sitch says most of this land won't be grown back as forests, at least not for decades.
But there's a lot of areas around the edge of the well pad that have been cleared, or perhaps areas that were used to store water trucks or fracking equipment that's no longer necessary when it's just in production.
And it's these areas, around the edges of gas development, that Sitch and his colleagues like Patrick Drohan want to resuscitate. Drohan, a soil scientist at Penn State, says the problem isn't just that the forest has been cut down. To build a well pad, companies use heavy equipment to compact the ground underneath.
Most of the time, what's done for these types of operations is they compact to what's called no movement. And that standard is similar when you're building a parking lot. It's similar to when you're building a shale gas pad.
And that's not good for plants to grow in. Compacted soil has fewer pores to store water or gases that a plant needs to survive.
So in this case, what we're trying to do is alleviate deep compaction. And to do that, you need to use big equipment to rip the soil.
The team brought in a bulldozer with a special attachment on it to cut into the compacted soil. Basically, they tilled the ground to varying depths to see which depth worked best. One row, at the far end of the plot, has not been loosened at all. Not surprisingly, it's doing worse than the rows that have been retilled. Again, Kelly Sitch.
That far row is much less drought tolerant than the other three rows, and we're seeing a lot more non-native invasive species that can still tolerate that very dry soil.
The goal, Sitch says, is to give gas companies step-by-step instructions for repairing and replanting the borders of their well pads, pipelines, and other construction areas. He doesn't think cost should be a problem for most companies.
You're really getting down to almost less than $2,000 an acre, which may be a lot of money to you and I, but when you're talking about multi-million dollar operations over many sites, it's not really very much of a money commitment.
For now, the agency isn't proposing to make any of these methods mandatory. And so far, Sitch says, gas companies have been receptive to the group's ideas. The Tyodotten State Forest is 150,000 acres. Sitch says even if they can only restore a few hundred of these, that would be worth it.
If we're creating habitat for insects, for songbirds, butterflies and moths, native plants, that's a great deal of real estate.
Bringing back some of the forest is better than none at all. Reed Fraser, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
We end tonight's show with a programming announcement. This is the final week for NewsWorks Tonight. Starting Monday at this time, you'll be hearing All Things Considered. And of course, you'll hear all the great work of our local news team throughout the day. In October, WHYY will be launching a new local news show and podcast. Stay tuned for details. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Listen back on your favorite podcast app or at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.